Dr. William Luther Pierce, 1999. Special Treatment.
Hello. St. Martin's Press has just published a fascinating new book. It's by journalist Gordon Thomas and is titled Gideon's Spies, The Secret History of the Mossad. Mossad is the name of Israel's official espionage and assassination agency. The history of the Mossad is an interesting enough subject in itself. All of the gory details about how our gallant little democratic ally in the Middle East carries out state-sponsored assassinations, terrorist bombings, and other hanky-panky, with nary a word of protest from that great enemy of terrorism we have in the White House. Bill Clinton likes to wax indignant about the terrorism of Osama bin Laden and Colombian rebels and Hutus in Uganda and others. That is, about the terrorism of everyone except our gallant little democratic ally in the Middle East. What makes Thomas's book especially interesting and relevant at the moment, however, is that he details some Mossad espionage inside the Clinton White House. Specifically, he reveals that Clinton knew that his steamy telephone sex sessions with his Jewish bimbo intern Monica Lewinsky were being tapped by the Mossad. We know that Clinton knew because he told Monica about it after an oral sex session in the Oval Office. And she told Special Prosecutor Ken Starr in sworn testimony what Clinton had told her. Clinton knew because the FBI's counter-espionage people knew and had warned him. Now, this is not really new because it was in the published Starr report. The Congress knew all about it during the impeachment process and the Senate trial. What is new is that it's finally beginning to get a little press coverage, the result of the publication of Thomas's book. It was all over the front page of the New York Post 10 days ago. Why didn't it get a lot of press coverage earlier? Well, the obvious answer is because the telephone tapping was being done by our gallant little democratic ally in the Middle East. And neither the media people nor the politicians in the Congress want to say anything bad about Israel. It's not good for one's career. Why is it important? Well, just think what it tells us about Mr. Clinton's character. He knew that his telephone sex sessions with Monica were being recorded by the Israelis because the FBI told him, but he didn't care. And he also didn't care that the FBI was tapping Monica's telephone, too. He warned Monica about it so that they could prepare a cover story in case the press learned about it. But he kept right on having telephone sex with Monica. Such irresponsibility is hard to fathom. To Clinton, being president is a game. The idea of the game is to have as much fun as possible while pretending to be a serious world leader. If you're a skillful enough liar and a good enough actor, you can get away with it, especially if your friends in the media cover for you, and if the people who like you because you feel their pain keep giving you a thumbs up on the popularity polls. Well, as I told you a long time ago, Clinton is a constitutional psychopath, and this is just one more indication of that fact. More important than what this telephone tapping tells us about Clinton's character and attitude is what it tells us about our relationship with our gallant little democratic ally in the Middle East. The Israelis, of course, always have waged an espionage war against America. Every time they get caught, as for example in the Jonathan Pollard case, they promise they will never do it again. And their apologists in the media and in the Congress explain that they really shouldn't be blamed because they're only spying on us so that Israel will be secure. They're surrounded by enemies in the Middle East, and they need every bit of national security information they can get. They can't trust anyone but themselves with their security, because during the Holocaust, everyone else let them down, we're told. Well, actually, we know from past experience that the Israelis not only steal our secrets, they sell these secrets to our enemies. Selling U.S. military and diplomatic secrets to the Soviet Union back during the Cold War was standard operating procedure for the Israelis. These days, they have a willing buyer for stolen secrets in the form of China. Beyond selling secrets, Israeli spying has a much more sinister purpose, as former Central Intelligence Agency Director William Casey indicated to Thomas in an interview. Most countries spy for security purposes. Israel spies in order to control the country on which she is spying, primarily through the blackmail of politicians. In the case of the Lewinsky telephone taps, there are strong indications that the Israelis used the information they collected to blackmail Clinton. They wanted him to halt an FBI search for an Israeli agent on the White House staff. Otherwise, they would leak their recordings of his telephone sex with Monica to the press. The White House denies there was any blackmail, and of course, the Israelis deny it. Gordon Thomas says that he has no evidence of direct Israeli blackmail and suggests that it probably was more subtle and indirect than that. All he can be sure of is that the Mossad was recording Bill and Monica's telephone sex sessions and that the FBI was looking for an Israeli spy in the White House. Beyond that, it's just speculation. But the search for the Israeli spy in the White House was halted. And then Mr. Clinton went right on having telephone sex with Monica, knowing that it was being recorded and, in addition, suspecting that some Jew on his staff was working secretly for the Mossad. But he didn't care. Can you imagine how frustrating that sort of thing must be for the FBI and other counter-espionage agencies? Well, that's life in the Clinton era. And of course, when the Senate voted on Clinton's articles of impeachment last month, every Jew in the Senate, Republican as well as Democrat, voted for acquittal. There are 11 Jews in the U.S. Senate, which, incidentally, is more than four times their quota of the U.S. population. During the impeachment hearings and the trial, some of these Jews said they were for Clinton, and some said they were against him. New York's Jewish Democrat Senator Charles Schumer loudly supported Clinton throughout the process. Connecticut's Jewish Democrat Senator Joseph Lieberman and Pennsylvania's Jewish Republican Senator Arlen Specter publicly denounced Clinton. But when the final showdown came, all 11 Jews quietly voted to keep Clinton in office. It makes one wonder about the genuineness of their denunciations of Clinton during the trial. What counted in the end was that Bill Clinton cannot say no to Israel, and he has appointed more Jews to his administration than any three other presidents. And all the Jews in the Senate and in the media appreciate that. That is what counts with them. The FBI is not the only American law enforcement agency which is frustrated by the unwillingness of Bill Clinton to say no to the Israelis. Israel continues to be the hideout of choice for Jewish criminals of all sorts fleeing from justice. A Jew commits a murder or a rape or some other serious crime in the United States, and if he's worried about being caught and punished, he simply catches the next flight to Israel. That country has a custom of refusing to extradite any Jewish criminal wanted for an offense against non-Jews in another country. Once a Jewish criminal reaches Israel, he is safe from prosecution and can thumb his nose at the world, no matter how heinous his crime. A recent example of this is the case of Maryland Jew Samuel Scheinbein. In September 1997, Scheinbein and another Jew, Aaron Needle, killed a non-Jewish teenaged neighbor, Alfredo Tello, in an argument over drugs. After the two Jews had bludgeoned, stabbed, and strangled Pello. They slashed his throat. Then they cut Pello's body up with a power saw and burned some of the parts. When the Maryland police came looking for him, Scheinbein got some money from his wealthy parents and hopped the next flight to Israel. He's been there ever since. The Israelis consider it immoral to turn a Jew over to Gentiles to be punished, and they have refused all requests by Maryland authorities for his extradition. Just over 2 weeks ago, on February 25th, the Supreme Court of Israel handed down a final ruling against efforts to extradite Scheinbein. The Israelis say they will put Scheinbein on trial in Israel for the murder of Alfredo Pello. So far, they haven't gotten around to it. And if they ever do, don't bet on a conviction. Another recent case of this sort of thing is that of Gore Goldberg, a Jew who committed an especially vicious murder in Houston, Texas. On November 27th of last year, the 20-year-old Goldberg walked into a wig shop near his Houston apartment, pulled out a knife, and began stabbing and slashing the two owners and a clerk. The owners survived the attack, but the 54-year-old clerk died of her wounds. Police familiar with Goldberg's past activities suspect that it was a thrill killing. He simply wanted to kill someone with a knife to see what it felt like. Goldberg was arrested, but like Scheinbein, he has wealthy parents. His parents put up bail to get him out of jail, and now Houston police say they have reason to believe that Goldberg has fled to Israel to escape prosecution. Now let me tell you, if it were any country but Israel, the U.S. government wouldn't tolerate this sheltering of criminals who have murdered U.S. citizens. At the very least, diplomatic relations would be cut off and economic sanctions would be imposed. But of course, Israel gets special treatment. Israel can do no wrong, not only in the eyes of the Clinton government, but in the eyes of virtually every government the United States has had in the last 50 years. When Jews in the United States collaborated in the theft of nuclear materials from a U.S. nuclear fuel processing plant and the smuggling of the material to Israel in 1962, President John Kennedy and the media here were interested only in covering it up, not in holding Israel and its collaborators to account. When the Israelis deliberately attacked and tried to sink a U.S. Navy vessel, the USS Liberty, in the Mediterranean in 1967, killing 35 U.S. citizens in the process, President Lyndon Johnson and the controlled news media in the United States didn't give a thought to punishing or even criticizing Israel for the murderous attack. Their entire concern was to keep the affair covered up, to keep the American public in the dark about it, and to protect Israel from any blame. The Liberty sent out an emergency call for assistance while it was under attack by the Israelis, and the U.S. 6th Fleet in the Mediterranean sent jet aircraft speeding to the rescue. As soon as Lyndon Johnson learned that it was the Israelis who were trying to sink the Liberty, however, he ordered the U.S. jets recalled and left the Liberty on its own. He was terrified of the potential political reprisals against him if Israelis were killed by U.S. jets. Better to let the Israelis sink the Liberty and kill her entire crew. Even today, the government's official story is that the attack on the Liberty was a mistake. And beyond that, no comment. And as it was with Lyndon Johnson in 1967, and with other U.S. presidents both before and since then, so it is with Bill Clinton today. U.S. government policy is that Jews can do no wrong. Israel can do no wrong. This policy is excused on the basis that Israel is our gallant little democratic ally in the Middle East, and that's why we give her special consideration in all things. But really, that's no excuse. Israel is no ally. Israel is and always has been nothing but an enormous liability for America. And it's not just Israel which gets special treatment. It's Jews generally, whether they run to Israel for protection or not. I'll give you an example of the special treatment reserved for Jews, which has gotten a very slight coverage in the news recently and has been noticed by those of us who notice such things. That's the case of Ira Einhorn. Einhorn was a Philadelphia area leader of the so-called counterculture revolution of the 1960s and 1970s, a revolution which Jews like to brag turned America upside down and changed young people's values. Bill Clinton was part of that revolution as a cheerleader for the Viet Cong and Ho Chi Minh and as an enthusiastic user of illegal drugs. Ira Einhorn was a smart, fast-talking Jewish con man who moved in the same circles as other Jews of his ilk in that era, Jerry Rubin, A.B. Hoffman, Allen Ginsberg. Einhorn was much more than just a cheerleader for the Viet Cong. He was a full-fledged New Age guru. He managed to promote himself successfully as a spokesman for everything that was trendy, the marvelous effects of LSD and other psychedelic drugs, pyramid power, various oriental religious cults, transcendental meditation, UFOs and extraterrestrials, CIA conspiracies. You name it, Einhorn was able to pass himself off as an authority on it. He also was a drug dealer. But mostly, he was a very wordy and self-confident Jew boy who was able to mesmerize Gentiles young and old and bring them under his sway, especially Gentile women. He managed to convince them that whatever nonsense he spewed on any subject was profound wisdom. This was the case despite the fact that he was fat, hairy, greasy-looking, and otherwise singularly unattractive, almost a stereotype of the Jew for whom the name Kike was coined. Of course, the Jewish media and Jews in the Philadelphia establishment helped Einhorn maintain his guru image by taking him seriously and giving him good press. One of the young Gentile women Einhorn mesmerized was a beautiful blonde girl from the little East Texas town of Tyler, Holly Maddox. Holly was not only beautiful, she was very bright and personable. She was a cheerleader in her high school and graduated as salutatorian. Then in 1965, she went off to Bryn Mawr University in Philadelphia. Bryn Mawr had been founded by Quakers, and in the 1960s, it was a hotbed of everything liberal, trendy, and destructive of the old-fashioned values Holly had learned in Texas. Holly began sleeping with Jews while she was at Bryn Mawr. She was fascinated by their wordiness and their self-assurance, which she mistook for genuine intellectual qualities, as many another naive Gentile girl has done. Eventually, she met Ira Einhorn, who had risen to become the head Jewish hippie of Philadelphia, and she fell under his spell. Einhorn persuaded Holly to move into his apartment, and she lived with him for 5 years, cooking and cleaning for him and sexually servicing him and letting herself be humiliated as he showed off his blonde shiksa slave to his Jewish friends. Then Einhorn murdered Holly and stuffed her corpse into a trunk on an enclosed back porch attached to his apartment. The odor finally attracted the police, who obtained a search warrant and discovered the girl's decomposing body. Einhorn was arrested and charged with Holly's murder in March 1979. Einhorn hired Philadelphia Jewish lawyer Arlen Specter, now a Republican U.S. senator, to get his bail reduced from $500,000 to $40,000. Einhorn put up the required $4,000 cash and split. He went to Canada and then to Europe in order to avoid prosecution for the murder of Holly Maddox. In Europe, he continued his role of New Age guru, and he continued attracting and using Gentile women. Well, Jewish women, too. His biggest financial supporter has been Barbara Bronfman of the infamous Bronfman liquor merchant and media family, which has been much in the news recently with demands for billions of dollars in reparations from the rest of the world because we haven't been treating Jews right. And for 20 years, this Jewish hippie guru has been living high in Europe, being supported by various women, and no one seems willing to hold him accountable for the murder of Holly Maddox. The French government finally decided a few weeks ago that he should be deported, but they have given him 2 years to appeal their decision. I have a suspicion that 2 years from now, Ira Einhorn will be in Israel. Well, these are just a few miscellaneous examples of the sort of special treatment Jews routinely get. Part of the reason they get it is the consequence of Jewish media control, which leads politicians and bureaucrats to handle Jewish criminals with kid gloves, lest anyone think they are being anti-Semitic. Part of it undoubtedly is the consequence of Israeli espionage and blackmail of the sort we have seen in the Clinton administration. But part of it also is that too many ordinary Americans let themselves be buffaloed by Jews. We let ourselves be flummoxed by the Jews' fast talk and air of self-confidence. When an Aryan meets a Jew, it is like a slow-talking country bumpkin meeting a slick, fast-talking carnival huckster. Our ancestors evolved in forest and field and on farms, fighting and working. Their ancestors have spent the last 10,000 years in the marketplaces and bazaars of the Middle East, buying and selling, wheeling and dealing, haggling and swindling. To us, words are for communication, for exchanging information. To the Jews, words are to disarm, to hypnotize, to mislead, to deceive. Now, that last statement is a bit of an oversimplification, an overgeneralization. But it is nevertheless substantially true. Despite all of the individual exceptions each of us can think of, despite all of the individual Jews we have met who are not especially tricky, and all of the Gentiles we have met who are, the general truth remains that as a race, we have let ourselves be taken advantage of by a tribe of very tricky con men. We are letting the Jews as a whole do to us, to our society, and to our civilization what Holly Maddox let Ira Einhorn do to her. And we must put an end to this situation very soon. We must put an end to the special treatment we have been giving Jews, or we certainly will end up the way Holly Maddox did. And for those Americans who really want to get Israel off our backs and get Jewish influence out of our lives, we're really going to have to change our ways. We're going to have to forget about the exceptions. We're going to have to look at everything in black and white with no shades of gray. Our situation is like that of Perseus in attempting to cut off the head of Medusa. One look for Perseus and the game would have been lost. If our people listened to the reasonable Jews, to the supposedly patriotic Jews, the honest Jews, we fall under their spell again. If we let them give us advice on how to deal with their tricky tribesmen, it's like the country bumpkin meeting the carnival huckster all over again. So it's going to be a rough and unpleasant future for us for a while yet. Thanks for being with me again today.